I'm Rainer Alvin Atkins, and this is...
I'm Rabbi Johanna Kinberg.
And thank you so much for coming to this discussion about guardian angels, or guardian angels. My background is that I'm trained as an artist. I've done a lot of work educationally, and both generally speaking and in the Jewish community. And I'm also... have been a political activist around a variety of issues, including Israeli-Palestinian peace. And Johanna was the person who got me here.
Yes.
You want to introduce yourself?
Sure. So I am a rabbi in Kirkland, Washington, Congregation Kol Ami, and spend most of my time doing Jewish education and teaching about Judaism, Jewish life, and my background is that my mother is from Morocco and my father is European Jewish. My mother's Moroccan Jewish. And so my influences come both from European but also North African Judaism, and which included the North African part, since most of the women in my family leading up to my grandmother's generation were not literate. There was a lot of the non-official religion and non-official prayers and amulets and all kinds of stuff that was been going on in Jewish civilization for a very long time that was never recorded and documented, but it was very much alive, and that includes a lot of stuff about angels and amulets and all kinds of stuff that were used for protection and healing for forever.
And for my part, my Jewish roots are Ashkenazi in Eastern Europe. I am trained as an artist, and I find that the education I got and the style of thinking I acquired in my training as an artist has been very useful in a lot of other parts of my life and activities, whether politically or educationally. And one aspect of that is I have become very fervent about mixing things up, about taking an integrated approach with arts and culture, spirituality and tradition, activism, with historical context, with really bringing these together. Because I think that when we look at any given subject in a segregated manner, just simply by itself, without reference to all the other influences on people's lives, that we make it poorer. And as an artist, I am just really fascinated by how creative people have been, humans have been, about storytelling, about what is sometimes called talking story, to really explain the world and understand the world. And it's also really fascinating how that has worked with what you imply, with how knowledge and power are used, and the different ways in which people build knowledge and interpretation, whether they're official or non-official patterns of activity. For me, the reason why I became interested in the idea of guardian angels actually happened a couple of years ago. Initially, I'm part of a Jewish community called Kadima in Seattle, and they do really big parties for the holiday of Purim. Purim is the holiday that celebrates the story of Esther and Mordechai and who saved the people from rapacious fascists, basically, and racists, and it's a holiday when things get turned upside down. And where there's a lot of opportunity for bringing other threads into the celebration of the holiday. And so there's been a theme for each of these parties. And that this year it had to do with breaking down walls. In this particular year, it had to do with what they called femmes on the run. And the idea of powerful women who had to keep on the move, one step ahead of the forces that wanted to keep them suppressed. And in this particular case, it was both people who have been born as women and trans women. And somehow in that context, the idea of guardian angels came up, protectors for people on the run. And also with what has been going on with refugees around the world, you know, refugees in the Mediterranean, fleeing what's been going on in Syria and other nations, and the desperation that families are working with. And also, I happened to read some very powerful writing about refugee children, the unaccompanied children trying to find safety. And at some point in the past, and my brain is not working to remember, I think I read some magic realist writing from Central America that somehow brought in the idea of guardian angels for people on the run trying to find safety. And so that's some of my thinking as an artist. I'm fascinated by these images and these and the storytelling. And I talked to Johanna about this, and then you brought up everything you just referred to in your introduction. And so Johanna's in an interesting position. I have a structure, and you get to be the spontaneous commentator. And because really, it was in the last few days that we confirmed, hey, want to do this together? So here we are. Having said all this, I have a request. And why don't we go around the room, say your name, say where you live, and what community, if it's applicable, you're part of, and just one to several words about angels in some way. And this is recognizing that the idea of angels is incredibly diverse. So curious to hear where you're coming from. And politically and etiquette-wise, I have a custom of starting with the left, moving to the left. Would you mind starting?
That's fine. My name is Christy Bernclaw-Halber, and I live in Canby, Oregon, and go to Spirit of Grace, which is a Lutheran Catholic community. And I don't use the word angel, really. But I have tremendous draw to mysticism. So there's a connection to mysticism. Mm-hmm. So there's a connection there. But I'm curious to explore.
Yeah. I'm Diana Bernclaw, connected here. I live in Canby also, and I am part of Zohar Lutheran Church community. And I am more just came to learn about the art and what people have to say about angels. I don't have any particular thoughts coming in.
My name's Kate Bernclaw-Halber, and I also live in Canby, Oregon. I go to Spirit of Grace. And, I'm here because I'm not really sure. I don't really have a clear image of what an angel is, and so I was hoping this session sort of expand my knowledge of that.
I'm Beverly Brewer. I also go to Spirit of the Grace, the Spirit of Grace, but I'm from the Catholic tradition, and just kind of interested. You know, I go back to my childhood about angels and hearing very specific teachings through the Catholic Church, and it's like, well, I don't really believe in angels, although I feel that there are people that have all the attributes of what you think an angel would be. And so, but I'm interested in other views of that. And,
my name is Lars Van Hansen. I'm living in the Lake City part of Seattle right now. Originally, I came from North Dakota. I went to school in Minnesota. I lived in Minnesota recently before I went out to Seattle. I'm part of the Our Redeemer Lutheran Church community. I'm very eclectic in my view of God and religion. I refer to Cahil Gibran, who some of you may know. One of the things he wrote was a prophet, and when he grew up in Lebanon, he had Jewish people and Muslim people and Christian people in his whole family. And one quote he said was, the major religions are the fingers on the hands of God. And then with his permission, hopefully, I said, and the fundamentalists are this finger. So I don't like the fundamentalists in any. I don't like the fundamentalists in any of the traditions, and they're all there. So angels, when I've had suffering, the lady that I was close to getting married to when I was in the Air Force kills herself. I feel like there was a lady in my apartment complex that I hadn't met before, and I, you know, there's no way to check it out, but she was in a position of healing when I found this tragic news. And so, I don't know, and then partly in some counseling, one counselor once told me, you have many angels around you, you know, like, I don't know, this was a person that claimed she knew how to, I don't know how she knew that. But I believe in angels. I mean, I believe in the scriptures. We talk about Gabriel. And so I believe God uses angels as messengers. But I don't talk about it much when I'm not suffering. I guess I have to suffer to meet my angels. It'd be nice to know how to meet them without suffering. So there you go. And I have a conflict this morning. There's a really good lecture starting at 11 in the next room, and I'm having cognitive dissonance.
Yeah, several people do.
Yeah,
I'm
definitely going to come back this afternoon because you're doing this again.
Well, this morning, I'll just interrupt the process to say this morning is going to be more talking and discussion and art history, and this afternoon will be more art making and talking about art. So it does have those two halves. Do it.
Thank you, Renee.
I'm Karen Craven. I'm currently from the Twin Cities in Minnesota. I'm a minister member of the Presbyterian Church, worshiping at a Lutheran church in an urban neighborhood, Our Savior's Lutheran Church. And
Chicago Ave.
And angels, I think of them in terms of emotional energy. And so there's an inner and an exterior dimension to them. As a chaplain, I've been at bedsides where people have talked and interacted with angels in their dying process. So I'm always interested in learning more about other people's experiences of them.
I'm Kate. I'm living and working here at the Village Potter. But I'm not of faith. And while I've been here in my work, I actually consider grief work around my mother's passing. And so I'm trying to recover memories and to reimagine her story. I'm drawn to the storytelling of angels or the people beyond and around us, the strength outside of us. And trying to find authentic and true articulations of that for myself.
Hi, my name is Badia Qureshi. I'm from Seattle. From the Muslim Association of Puget Sound. That's where my husband acts as an assistant imam, which is like a religious leader. In the Islamic tradition, we definitely have a concept of angels. It is part of our faith to believe that they do exist. and we consider them beings of light, made out of light, as we are made out of clay. They're made from light. I've never had any interaction with any angels. They are fantastic. There's fantastic descriptions of some of them, what they look like Gabriel, and the one that will blow the trumpet on the day of judgment. I mean, we have a few descriptions here and there. It's fascinating. Angels of protection around us.
Yeah.
There's so much to it. I'm not sure, but I'm excited to figure out what you all think. And it's a really interesting topic.
I'm John Lewis, I'm from Seattle, where I am a member of St. Therese Catholic Parish, and I also attend the Muslim Association of Puget Sound. And it's fascinating to me because we share so much, as I learn more about Islam, and such as the angel Gabriel, who we refer to as an archangel, and their stories are so similar. And so we have a great tradition in our Catholic faith about angels and archangels. And then it's such a strong presence in Islam. But I want to learn more.
I'm Joanne Shad. I grew up Lutheran and became a pastor when I was attending a United Methodist Church. And so I've lived many places as a result of that, including Alaska. And I've heard different stories from especially indigenous people, such as in Alaska, about spiritual presence. And so I trust that to be true. And I enjoy that you're integrating not only different faith traditions, but the art. I think that's going to be just really exciting.
I'm Claudia Craig. I live in Chehalis, Washington, which is halfway between Seattle and Portland. I'm a member of Emmanuel Lutheran in Centralia. Our congregation, our physical building also houses a state congregation and a Messianic Jewish congregation, which is kind of an interesting situation. And I guess, you know, personally, as I get older, I find that I'm becoming always more liberal and inclusive in my own personal theology. And I'm interested in the relationship between theology and different faith traditions and science and other belief systems. Like Joanne, a lot of the spirituality traditions of Native Americans fascinate me. I find that very rich. I've always been fascinated since I was a little girl by angels and scriptures. I always wanted to meet one. And then as I get older and I listen to some of those experiences of people who are older and or dying and their experiences with seeing long gone relatives, I think, are those angels? And have I met one yet? I don't know. I hope that I do meet an angel, and when I do, I hope I know that I did.
Why don't we go to the back and then return to the couch level?
I'm Lynn. I'm from Seattle. I'm a community of Our Redeemer's Lutheran Church in Ballard. When I think of angels, I kind of think of people coming to me in times of need. And sometimes I don't realize it until, like, after the fact that that was an angel, you know, leading me. So I'm just interested to see what you all think.
I don't believe the Hallmark card type angel, really cherubby type stuff. And it strikes me in scripture that angels are often kind of terrifying. And there's some beings that one struggles with or that carry news that totally shift one's perception. And so, you know, I don't know, I also have a mystical bent, and so I've had some experiences where I heard a voice. You know, what would I call that voice? But that voice to me had a message that calmed my soul or that opened up something for me. And so I consider that very sacred. Maybe somebody would call that an angel's voice. Because I don't know. I don't know. Well, you know, there's a mystery out there.
Oh, your name?
Oh, Jennifer from Portland, Oregon.
I'm John. I'm also from Portland, Oregon. And I'm a member, well, I grew up as a Catholic and then became Lutheran when I married. And the church I'm a member of, Spirit of Grace, may be the only church in the U.S. where Lutherans and Catholics worship together. That's kind of cool. So my guardian angel is my dad. He taught me how to work with my hands and how to do projects and woodwork and how to fix things. And so there's always projects around the house. And I find I get inspiration from him and problem-solving inspiration about how to do something when I'm stumped.
Tell him when you die.
Oh, he died when I was 15. Yeah. But anyway, that's the presence that I get from a guardian angel.
I'm Carol Goodstein, and I don't even know what to say. I'm interested in the angel, how everybody expresses that in different cultures or whatever. I don't know where I'm from either. Born in Chicago, grew up in Idaho, spent a lot of time in Oregon and Washington, stuck in California right now. Wish I was back in the Northwest. Anyway, I think I've had at least two experiences with angels, and it seems for me that God, like you, also brings them around in time of stress or need or whatever, and then also I get a bit of God's sense of humor, which keeps me involved.
I'm Janet Weller. I'm from the Midwest, Wisconsin, Michigan. Right now I live in Indiana. Lutheran up until about 2 years ago. We moved to Angola and we joined the United Church of Christ there. My husband loves to sing, so we joined the choir there. But anyway, it's also a very open and accepting church, which we found that we really like. And I think I've always believed in angels as long as I can remember. I collect angels, and yes, most of them are not fierce enough, I agree. But I think sometimes some of them represent parts of myself, like I have a dancing angel, has a tambourine, and it looks like she's having a wonderful time, and I think that's really great. And I have an angel that's pondering things, and I think that's, it's just a representation. But mostly, I think of angels as a pathway to God, a spiritual pathway. I'd like to just find out more. I don't know.
Oh, I'm Deb from Seattle. Started sourced by Orthodox Jews and have moved to a state of spiritual atheism. Angels were never part of my upbringing. Nobody talked about angels. I am aware of angels in Torah, but never really meant anything. And of course, the Hallmark stamp, the angel on top of the Christmas tree, all of that, just like, okay, it's cute. And somehow cute didn't mean much, although I like cute. And you came to our kitchen, talked with Reiner, and you talked about angels as messengers, and all of a sudden something clicked for me, that pretty much anything can be a messenger, because I do believe in metaphor, and whatever sparks us, it could be, pine needle floating down, spiraling on the wind. I don't need to consider that, a message from God. It is, and if I'm looking at it, and that spiral turns me a little toward a place of wonder from wherever else I might have been, then why not? Somebody else might consider that a spiritual experience. For me, it's just an experience, but it's a lovely one. So I wanted to hear more.
Well, my name is Nora, and I'm from Wenatchee, and I grew up my mom telling us that we have a guardian angel, and who protect us and who guide us, and we also pray to our angel, because we have a beautiful prayer for our guardian angel, but I have never, like, as growing up, I have never had any encounter. I hear people saying, and it's like, what is the key to have those or to learn more? So that's why when I was reading that it's going to be the angel talk, I was like, okay, I have to go and see what all of you have to say about it. And maybe one day I can have an encounter and learn a little more. And I know that because in the Bible tells us that they're sending by God. So it's something that fascinates me and I want to learn.
I'm Amber Dixon. I use she, her, hers pronouns, and I live in Spanaway currently. I attend a UCC church in Seattle, Washington. I grew up in kind of fundamental, in a way, a Christian tradition that had a lot of dualistic thinking, so like good and evil, demons and angels. And so I always saw like angels as kind of like scary, but protecting against whatever was evil or bad in my upbringing. And I've kind of like shifted away, and I'm trying to look for a way to reclaim some of those things that were in my upbringing, but just with a different light. So just here to learn.
Thank you so much for sharing. I think that the comments you all made define the diversity of how people see this. And I myself, and probably you, we don't have any particular answers to do angels exist and such, but the conversation, the process is really valuable. In the Jewish tradition, it's been interesting to learn more because, number one, there's been dynamics of some of the teachers saying, well, angels exist. We have a tradition of angels, but you better watch out because, you know, fear about angels diverting people from a relationship with the divine, that people are paying attention to more than one aspect of the divine. And also, my understanding is that in history of Judaism, there's been a tug of war between what I'll call the ecstatic and feeling expression and the more, what would you call it, kind of rational, almost not really scientific approach, but
legalistic,
yeah. For example, in Eastern Europe, there's a Hasidic tradition where you can dance to worship, and there were the Mikdadim who were very much more legalistic, and there was this real tug of war, and people were being told, well, you know, watch out for believing in angels, but the regular folk really, there are so many ways that they have almost defied the authorities and hung on to these stories and these traditions that gave texture to their lives, and offered ways to try to work with the condition of the world. In Jewish homes, and maybe you can break this down more, every Friday night we sing a song about angels. Shalom Aleichem, peace be with you. And would you like to take that
song
and define that?
Absolutely.
How that gets used?
So, every Friday night, it was a 17th century table song, so it was sung around the Sabbath table on Friday evening. And now we sing it mostly in our synagogues on Friday nights. I'll sing just a little bit of it for you so you can hear what it sounds like. Shalom Aleichem, Malachi Hashari, Malachi Elyon, Mi Melech Malachi Hamlachim HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So that's just a little tidbit. And it's a song all about welcoming angels of love and kindness to our table. Now, there's also a protective nature of that, and I talk about this a lot on Friday nights, is thinking about
Jews who've been sitting at their Friday night table over the last several thousand years, and the feeling of wanting protection, that only good people can come through our door, only protective forces come through our door as we sit down to enjoy this meal, that all week we've been working and toiling and working, and now we come, we wash, we put on our finest clothes, we eat the best food that we're going to eat all week, challah, which is, you know, it has egg in it, so that's super special. It's basically cake. And you're going to, everybody's going to come around, but you sort of do this protective song of just wanting your home and your table to be surrounded by angels so that you can have this 25-hour period of peace. So it is a summoning of protective angels so that you can have peace in your home. And even though we don't actually, you know, so much of Judaism has veered towards the rationalistic, we don't actually talk about the fact that we, every Friday night we sit down and conjure angels, but that's what we do. And so,
I never thought about it. I just think
it's, right, it's our angel conjuring. And that's how we begin the Sabbath, is we light candles, we drink, you know, we bless wine, we bless the bread, and we conjure the angels so we can create this space of renewal and rest.
And we invite the angels in, mm-hmm. and come in peace. Come in peace. Bless us in peace.
Yes. And go in peace.
Okay. And leave in peace. Yes. And so, and yeah, every Friday night. We do sing it at our table.
We do.
A lot. And
if you're all in Seattle,
and there's another, and just a couple other things to throw out before I'll pass this handout around. Angels, there's also the tradition of people becoming angelic-like figures. And again, there's an aspect of the home. So at the end of the Sabbath, and also during the holiday of Passover, Elijah, the prophet Elijah figures. And Elijah is the prophet who comes before the Messianic age. And so there's special reference to that as we say goodbye to the Sabbath. One of the final songs we sing before wishing each other a good week is about Elijah the prophet bringing to us speedily the Messianic age in our days, in our times. And on Passover, there's a point in the Passover Seder where the door is opened, and there's a special cup for Elijah, for Eliyahu. And at our Seders, we have the custom of passing the cup around, and everybody fills the prophet's cup from their cups. And then a kid goes to open the door, and maybe an adult kind of bumps the table a little, so the cup kind of trickles by. But the point is that this figure is visiting every Jewish home in the world at that moment, and it's a powerful image. And Elijah's one of the figures who never officially died, mm-hmm. yeah, but is swept up to the heavens in a chariot. And I learned about another figure that I like to think of as a balance. As a partner to Elijah, Sir Ahbad Asher. So Sir Ahbad Asher, I believe, is mentioned two times in the Torah, two little tidbits in the Torah. As the Israelites go into Egypt, and when they leave Egypt, and how much time is supposed to have elapsed?
300?
Like 300 years?
Yes, or 300 years when it was the gap between Genesis and Exodus, when
yeah.
the voice, you know, where the connection goes quiet.
So Elijah wanders the world, often portrayed as a beggar, as a poor person, someone who hangs out with the sick people at the gate of the city and such, and is wandering the world, waiting for us to get it together, to pull it together, so we can bring the age of peace and justice, universal peace and justice. Sir Ahbad Asher, in my understanding, Elijah is looking towards the future. Sir Ahbad Asher is the keeper of memories. And to make it really drastically simple,
She's the person who, when the Jews are leaving Egypt, knows where Joseph's bones are. And so they can take them out of Egypt. And of course, she's been around, the daughter of Asher, one of the 12 sons of Jacob. She's lived for 300 years. She's telling people, hey, I remember where these are. And then through history, she keeps popping up saying, this is the way it was. When we were at the Sea of Reeds, crossing the sea, it was like a hall of mirrors. And she pops up, I think, in Yavne, mm-hmm. in some stories. And, you know, there's different ideas about how long she was around. But what I've heard the most is that around 1,000 years ago, she swept up into the heavens like Elijah was. So this idea of these figures who started out as humans and then took on a much more expanded role, and they visit people. They come and they teach people, this is how it was. They go to every home and they say, hey, remember, there's a future of hope. That's a really powerful idea, and that fits into the idea of angels in the Jewish tradition. Do you want to add something?
I was
going
to add about Elijah the prophet is that the idea is that, you know, sort of like the Jewish Santa Claus, where he manages to visit everyone's home on one night, you know, and we don't, it's always a great mystery, but you're supposed to leave your door open. And the idea is that when everybody's doors are left open and when everybody welcomes in the homeless person, the person who looks like the person you most don't want to welcome into your home, that will usher in the Messianic era, or for Christians, the coming of the Messiah. We say the Messianic era because we put that a focus on a person, but a time of the lion and the lamb and universal peace. And so we have a lot of traditions about homeless people and beggars, and that they are dressed up, they're actually like angels dressed up and are testing them. And so when you walk by someone, and especially around holidays and the Sabbath, it's like, I always give, because that's, you know, it could be, you know, you don't know, my parents really drilled into me, you don't know, that could be Elijah the prophet. And you could just be walking right by, and that you have to honor each human that you encounter as though they were possibly a divine being. And so it's sort of, you know, it gets your head into this certain place about who and what you're seeing in this world, and to second guess and question yourself about your reaction to the other. Because, you know, for at least from the voice of my parents, you know that you're going to be tested by your interaction with who you consider to be the other.
And in that context, it's important to think, it feels important to think of how the initial human was made, B'Tselem Elohim, an image of the divine, and that we all have that spark of the divine in us. So when we look at these people who have such potential, that's a very important idea. So there's a spectrum in the Jewish tradition, I imagine other traditions. There's a mention of angels sometimes being terrifying, and also angels being benevolent. There's angels that have very specific form that's very human. Angels that often have a very kind of mystical, miraculous identity that perhaps has human. You know, there's certainly the image of angels as heavenly beings with wings. And then there's angels that are very abstract, literally abstract, that don't particularly have human form. One more comment about angels visiting the home. When we were at Shavuot, I was doing something like this, and Chaim Katzman, who's Israeli, said, oh, when I was growing up, every time a baby was born, all the kids were asked to come in into the home, and we would sing the song about the guardian angels, about Gabriel, Michael, Gabriel, Michael, Raphael, Uriel, the guardian, you know, these four primary angels being gathered around that baby. And Do you have more that you want?
Well, yes, I mean, there's a bed, so there's, Shema is the, our central prayer, Hear, O Israel, the Eternal is our God, the Eternal is one. And you say it in the morning, before you go to sleep, and the bedtime prayer includes a visualization of the four ministering angels surrounding you before you go to sleep. So you, that's another time where you would conjure angels, is I call upon Uriel, Raphael, Gabriel, and to surround me. And so my mom actually does a project where she makes mobiles that go above a child's bed with four angels, so that when you, and you can see their names. So when you lay down, you look above and you have the names of the angels that surround you. So this is, of course, to, for comfort, for peace, in order to be able to sleep, you know, is that imagining. And in Judaism, sleep is considered 1/60th death, and dreams are considered 1/60th prophecy. So there's something about going to sleep that's very about reconnecting with the source and the divine and needing protection to, as you go through that journey and then returning to yourself. So, yeah, we can, I mean, there's a lot of mysticism in Judaism. We could go deep, but the bedtime Shema is, the bedtime prayer is when you do, especially teaching children to, you know, it's also self-soothing. It's creating a ritual for comfort, and being able to call on these forces to protect you.
Exactly, and that image of Chaim when he was a little boy and other children, he said, okay, children, come. You need to sing the song around
yes.
the baby.
Yes.
It's really nice. So, so I have a handout. I'm wondering if someone could share and give Johanna one.
Oh. And you don't have one either. Anybody else?
Yeah. I have
okay.
my own copy.
I'll just listen. It's okay.
So I want to emphasize, this is something I put together, and I'm really still researching, and Johanna is here as well. So don't hesitate to speak up. Johanna is playing a role, and this is. So just reviewing some of the questions. First of all, in terms of vocabulary, in Hebrew, angel is malach. And it's interesting because Hebrew is full of puns and wordplay. And malach is awfully close to the word for sovereignty, for ruler. So malach can either mean an angel or it can mean to be a king or to rule. So it is and it isn't. And we've already talked about what we imagine, what we could imagine an angel to be, what form does an angel take, and we will continue to talk about that. How were angels useful for our ancestors? Is it relevant now? We've begun to talk about how angels are expressed in different cultures. And is the idea, are these ideas we brought up of angels and that we'll talk about more, are they relevant to this particular era when themes of what I call the two R's, resilience and resistance, are so important when the world is in such turmoil?
Mm-hmm. Should probably also talk in that way with about fallen angels or what sometimes you might call evil angels. I don't know, but fallen angels, I think.
Yeah. And actually, something I was going to say, and you reminded me of it, is the role of angels in arguing with God. And giving God an opportunity to be just, among other things. I'm thinking about the Midrash, about the Egyptian army drowning in the Sea of Reeds.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I just want to say also, Judaism is fundamentally non-dualistic. And so Satan was never considered to be a bad or fallen angel, just an angel. He was the annoying angel. The one is the angel that inspires people to become lawyers. Is the living angel. So we just considered him to
or
be
rabbis.
Or rabbis. is the one who pokes and prods and annoys and is that you know won't shut up and let you just be angel. But within the Jewish context, it was never seen as apart from God or separate from God, because since we're non-dualistic, everything has to be part of God in some way. There is no anything other than God. And so our non-dualism sort of shaped our identity, our understanding of angels all being, and the language I use is refractions of divine light. So the idea that, you know, if you put a crystal, like a crystal in a window, and sometimes the light is just shining the right way that it puts a stream of light. And if you're sitting there in the right place at the right time, you get to experience a refraction. And that's at least, I just wanted to throw that in there right now. That's just at least how I've understood angelic forces, is to be refracted divine light at a very specific place, time, and moment where you're able to understand and see and read what's happening.
And that plugs into ideas of the importance of having free will, of being able to distinguish and make decisions, and the idea that no matter how far we fall, we've still got the ability to make teshuvah, which means to turn ourselves around, to return, to repent, and get back on a path of decency and compassion. And also, it's mentioned in this handout a little bit later, but regarding the song Shalom Aleichem, peace be with you, to the angels visiting, there's also the idea that in a sense, you know, you've seen those images of a character on each shoulder.
Yeah.
So that when you're going home on the eve of Sabbath, you've got an angel that represents the Yetzer Hara, the sassy, you know, often described as the evil inclination, and that Yetzer HaTov, the good inclination, and that these are manifested in angelic form. And it's, you know, they're there to respond to your circumstance. Are you ready to go into the Sabbath in a positive frame of mind? Or are you going into the Sabbath, into your home, and in a mindset of contention and discomfort? And the idea that we need that little angel that is the sassy angel and so on. If we don't have that in our life, we're not really fully human. We don't have the ability to make the distinctions and to exercise our free will and to be in partnership with what's holy in the world. So this is just some different examples of angels and the different forms they take. And I think that we can perhaps just, why don't we go to the right this time? If we could just read and chime in.
Starting where?
Starting with examples of angels in the Torah. And angels, the idea of angels takes different forms. So, would you like to start?
I agree.
What
does anybody
an
know
angel
what Torah is? Enough.
Pardon?
Do you need any? Does everybody know what Torah is? It's what Jews call the first five books.
Yeah, the five books of Moses is the Torah. That's what's written in the Torah scroll. And when we use word terms like Tanakh, it's an acronym for all the Hebrew scriptures, the Jewish scriptures, including the prophets. And there is some really wild angelic talk in the book of Ezekiel. So we'll be moving from angels that seem just like you or I to angels that are very hallucinogenic.
All right, so as bearers of information, An angel appears to Hagar, Sarah's maidservant, and informs her that she will bear a son whose descendants will be numerous. Three visitors bring the news that Sarah will give birth the following year.
So, context. Anybody remember in what context an angel is appearing to Hagar in the Bible?
She's in the wilderness. She's
and why is she in the wilderness?
Sarah has had a little tantrum and sent her off.
So Hagar has despaired. She has put her son off to the side and said, I don't want to see him die. And there's a manifestation, an angelic manifestation, telling her exactly this. So making things right, and that the son, that Ishmael will survive, that Ishmael will be the ancestor of a great nation. So making things right. And then the three visitors coming to the tent of Abraham and Sarah, and this is where the whole idea of the value of hospitality begins, in as it gets taught, hospitality to guests, that Abraham puts everything aside and greets these three individuals coming to the tent. And then after Abraham has been a mensch, a decent person, then this information is purveyed. And Sarah hears it and just laughs.
And it starts the connection also between the stranger and the angel. And that you know, Abraham's sitting in his tent, three people are coming towards him, he doesn't know them, and the sort of the meta lesson embedded in this is you don't know. When people are coming, when there's a stranger coming towards you, you don't know. It could be an angel. You have to sort of suspend your anxiety, your fear, your xenophobia, your all the things that come up with strangers, and instead put in the delight of mystery, which is not, doesn't come to us, you know, as human beings. When we see a stranger, we might want to react with a place of closed door. This is, oh, this is a mystery. I don't know what's going to unfold. This is the possibility of a divine moment or interaction.
Can you read, we've already talked about Hagar. Can you read where it says when Abraham?
When Abraham said, so that it is sacrificed, the child of Sarah in him, Isaac, it is again an angel of God. It cries out to him and instructs him to not to harm people.
So, this is what I'll be doing tomorrow, this story. And in a sense, the angel not only restrains the act of what could be murder, essentially. I mean, it's God's sacrifice, but killing one's child, and opens the eyes. And in this particular story, again, there's wordplay, because yirah and yirah, one means vision and one means awe. How do those coincide? And this act of intervention brings those two together. And of course, can be seen as ending the practice of sacrifice, of human sacrifice. Although, of course, we struggle with that now with war and other things. Who would like to read next about Jacob?
The patriarch Jacob wrestles with an angel all night. In the morning, when Jacob asks his adversary to identify himself, the angel admonishes him not to ask. Afterwards, Jacob names the place Peniel, literally, face of God. In explaining this choice, Torah may explain that the wrestling adversary was an emissary of God. I have seen a divine being face to face, yet my life has been preserved.
You brought this up, and I wasn't sure whether you were talking about the angel in the story, or about the donkey also being an angel?
Oh, in this story, you mean the next one with Bilam's
yeah.
donkey? Do you want me to read the text?
And sure.
Balaam's donkey has the power of speech. This is actually our Torah portion. We'll be reading it aloud from the Torah this Saturday. Is there more than one angel in the story? Balaam, the seer, is riding on his she-ass. That always goes over very well. We read English to deliver a paid for an advance curse of the Israelites. An angel blocks his donkey. Only the donkey can see the angel. The first time the angel appears with a drawn sword, the animal intelligently swerves off the path. Balaam whacks her. The second time the angel appears in a narrow space between two vineyard walls, mashing Balaam's foot. Balaam whacks her again. The third time the angel chooses such a narrow place on the path that the animal's only option is to lie down, and Balaam whacks her again. Whereupon the she-ass turns to Balaam and speaks. And so I was just also wondering about the connection between the angel and the animal, because I've also in my life had experiences of not just animals, but also nature, whether it's a wind or a tree or something, in terms of being a refraction in that moment and place and that experience. And Martin Buber talks about his first spiritual experience as a child being with a pony, and that he, when he is interacting with the pony, he says, "I am moved by this pony, and this pony is moved by me, though we have no words. We're not using language." And so I've always connected animals and the nature to being able to receive and understand messages that are outside the context of human language. And that perhaps things can also manifest in that way, that it's a language-less interaction that can happen in that way. So, and that sort of, it was sort of inspired by this story, although the donkey does speak eventually.
Yes, and this whole story is wonderful because when Balaam keeps trying to curse, the curse is transformed to a blessing, and that blessing is in a lot of synagogues the opening of a service.
Matovu.
Yes.
How lovely are your tents, O Jacob, your dwelling places, Israel. And the scene might come into your mind that he was supposed to be cursing the Israelites. He's standing on a big cliff, and the Israelites are encamped, 600,000, mixed multitude below him. As the text says, as far as you could see, that there were Israelite encampments. And he's supposed to do this curse, but instead comes out of his mouth is, how lovely are your tents, O Israel, your dwelling places, Israel. And so that's how we open our prayer services, by singing those words that were supposed to be cursed but became a blessing.
Sounds kind of like Holden Village, doesn't it?
Yes.
Moses, wandering in the wilderness, has an angel appear to him in a blazing fire out of a thorn bush, a bush aflame but not consumed. God's voice then calls out to Moses from the bush.
There's a lot of different interpretations about what Moses says, that there's flaming letters in the bush, but this interpretation is that there's actually an angelical force within the bush. And then there's Exodus.
In Exodus 23:20, God tells Moses, "Behold, I am sending an angel before you to guard you on the way and to bring you into the place which I have prepared. Beware of him and obey him, for my name is within him."
Which I think expresses very much what you were talking about the manifestation of divinity. And also the angel takes different forms in some interpretations, as the pillar of fire or the pillar of smoke.
My name is within him. Jews don't pronounce the name of God. I don't know what the name of God is. We have indications of it. We have a zillion different euphemisms and metaphors, but the name is not to be spoken. So if this entity has the name of God within, that's quite a powerful statement. Mm-hmm. And that's as far as I'm going to go with it. But it's written,
and all the angels have God's name.
They're
all something, something, El. El is God. So Michael, Gabriel. And when you see the full name of angels, there's like so many of them. They all have have Michael, they all have the L in there, so God's name is within them.
Gabriel,
yeah.
Raphael. And all of those prefixes before the L have a meaning, and perhaps we'll talk about that.
I'd like to, well, let's keep going. So, angels and visions and prophecies. You can read it on the next page at the top.
As Jacob flees the consequences of his trickery of his father Isaac and his brother Esau, he lies down to sleep and in his dream sees a ladder set upon the earth, and the top of it reached to heaven, and behold the angels of God ascending and descending on it.
And there's so much to work on there. By the way, what does he say when he wakes up? Anybody remember?
Something about that this place he has seen God, and then he names it, I think, what, Ephah? Is it God?
Yes, he wakes up. Yeah, and God was here, and I did not know.
Yeah. Except he marks it, and then,
yes,
I know
and then he marks it. And we'll look at this a little bit more, but who wants? Now we're getting into the hallucinogenic.
Perfect. In the first chapter of Ezekiel, the prophet encounters four creatures.
Coyote
in Hebrew. That resemble human beings, but each has four faces. Human, lion, ox, and eagle. Four wings, and their legs are fused into a single leg.
So, if you, when many people daven, when they pray in a synagogue during the Amidah, the standing prayer, the silent prayer, a lot of people will stand like this. And we have a tradition that in Yiddish it's called shuckling, where you see people as they pray, kind of bobbing and weaving, but keeping their feet together. Why? Because the angels in heaven are monopods.
There's also another point in that service where we actually go up on our tiptoes. We say,
yes.
Holy, 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 kadosh, 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 Adonai Svaot, the Lord of hosts, Melokol Haaretz Kavodo, his glory fills the whole world. And so you're supposed to go up on your tiptoes as you say that, because the idea is that one day we'll just take off. That we're revving up for flight.
Oh,
so,
I like that.
Like, which day are we just going to rev up and fly away?
There's a little choreography to Jewish prayer. And actually, also at the beginning of the service, you take three steps back and three steps forward. And those three steps forward, one person said, it's like you're launching yourself
right into...
Not every congregation does this.
No.
I wasn't raised with that.
Why don't you continue with Ezekiel? And we'll look at more of Ezekiel.
In Ezekiel, there are angelic beings called Ophanim, shaped like the wheels full of eyes, round about. They are also frequently referred to as many-eyed ones.
Okay, thank you. And now we're going to dive into just some tidbits from the tradition of rabbinic midrash. How do you like to define midrash?
It's fan fiction. That's what I call it. It's basically fan fiction. So it was people who are writing stories about stories in the Bible. It's like, you know, with people in Harry Potter, they'll write stories with all the characters, but extend the story using their own imagination. So when all we had was the five books, the scroll, people would write fan fiction about it. They would write these stories that were expansions. They're creative. There's no grounding in anything that, you know, what they're writing. They're really just using their imaginations to fill in blanks, answer questions, entertain, make commentary, but it essentially is fan fiction.
And often to wrestle with the text.
And to wrestle with it too, yes.
One of the examples of God using angels as counterpoint is at the Sea of Reeds. Angels are celebrating in the heavens, and God speaks to them and says, why are you rejoicing? Aren't the Egyptians my creation as well? So somebody was wrestling with the story. And Midrash is
part of the tradition of the oral Torah, the spoken Bible. And I was really moved by this, by the quote from one of the Midrashic sources right below Angel's Rabbinic Midrash. Whose turn is it to read?
There were two angels to every one of them. One to lay his hand on the heart of each one, to keep their hearts still, and one to lift each one's head, so that they might behold the splendor of the Creator. Midrash Asarat HaDibrot.
So this image of keeping the heart still, but also lifting up the head. I like that.
And was this? And this is a description of the moment of revelation. So the idea is that when they were at Sinai, that each individual had, it was such an awe-inspiring experience that each person had an angel cover their heart, keeping their heart from beating out of their chest, but also keeping their heads up so that they would bear witness to what was happening, which might have been terrifying.
Gabriel is the angel that protected the infant Moses when he was placed upon the breast of the river Nile and discovered by Pharaoh's daughter, Bathia.
Let's continue. Can you? One of you read?
Midrash tells us that the child Moses would play with the royal crown, placing it on his own head. The Pharaoh's magicians saw this as an evil omen and conspired to trap the boy. A beautiful work of gold and a glowing coal were placed before Moses to measure his intelligence. If he displayed normal sense and reached for the gold, he'd be killed. An angel made Moses reach for the coal and raise it to his mouth, which burned his lips. His speech was impaired for the rest of his life, but he survived.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that's the example of fan fiction if they explain why he had a speech impediment.
Midrash identifies Michael, Gabriel, Uriel, and Raphael as the four chief angels who surround the divine throne, each of whom has particular attributes.
The Talmud identifies Michael, Gabriel, and Raphael as the three angels who visited Abraham to deliver the news that his wife will bear a son. Though the Bible records that the men ate a meal that Abraham had prepared for them, the rabbis stipulate that the trio only appeared to eat. Since being angels, they are not physical beings, but merely resemble them.
Another Midrash describes the debate among the angels about whether human beings should be created. In this debate, the angel of love is in favor of creating humans because of the human capacity for expressing love, but the angel of truth disagrees, fearing that humans will be prone to falsehoods. In support of creating humans, God shows the angels examples of righteous people from the Bible, but the angel of earth rebels and denies the angel Gabriel the dust he needs for the creation of people, fearing that humans would wreak devastation on the earth. The angel of Torah argues against human creation too, contending that people should not be created because they will suffer. Mm-hmm. And we already talked about the last one. That is an interesting debate, Johanna.
About the angels discussing whether humans should be created.
Yes.
Would it harken back to stories of people in the Bible?
And again, these are Midrash. This is Midrash. These are
right.
Stories that.
So there are already stories about non-existent humans.
We do time travel. Major time travel.
The Judaism and Jewish text is startlingly non-linear, and so these texts, Midrash was written sometime between the year, probably between 0 and 300 of the Common Era, so they're post-Second Temple. They might have been oral traditions, but they weren't written down. But these are post-Second Temple texts, so they're creating, people at that time, all these conversations about angels, debating whether human beings should even exist or not, and the kind of impact that humans have on the planet. But they're discussing this a long, long time ago. It's a vehicle, it's a tool for being able to discuss reality, is to use these characters. And so the angels' concerns were really their concerns. That's
right.
What they were, yeah. but it's a wonderful tool to be able to have conversations about important matters.
Imagine a child saying, "Why did this horrible thing happen?" And you say, "Well, you know, we've been asking that question for a long time. You're not the first one to notice that things aren't always jolly. And you know, the angels have been arguing about it since before creation." So the child becomes one in a long line of people who have had deep thoughts.
So there is the idea that angels do argue with God, and they have a degree of independent agency that complicates the idea of angels as just messengers carrying out divine objectives. The rabbis of the Talmud were sometimes concerned that angels could become objects of worship in and of themselves. And there was sometimes an emphasis that was made that righteous people can equal or even surpass the holiness of angels. That righteous people are greater than the ministering angels. That, because again, among other things, we have free will. Angels frequently don't. And this is a particular midrash that I really liked. I came across it relatively recently. Midrash tells us that Esther had the assistance of 3 or 4 angels as she prepared herself to intervene with the king. It's pronounced Ahasuerus. In many texts, the Hebrew name is Ahasuerus, on behalf of the Jewish people. So Queen Esther, in her story, she needs power. And there's one angel to make her radiant, to shine with light and beauty. There's another angel to raise her up and for her to stand tall. Another angel to open the king's eyes so that the king can recognize her. And another angel to reach the king's hand forward with the scepter. Because, you know, there's a whole ritualistic pomp and circumstance deal about how she has to engage with the king, even though he's her husband, to save her people. But the idea that there were 3 or 4 angels involved with each step of that process is very interesting. But note that they're providing support, but she still has to take the action. And now we're getting into a bit of the guardian angels. I think we've had really good discussion, including at the beginning. I'm thinking that maybe it may make sense to reserve the art history for the art making part of things.
Would you like people to read ahead, and if anybody's coming back later, to be more familiar with this, maybe take a peek at it over lunch?
I just want to make a comment here. So these 4 angels that are the archangels are sort of the main ones. And there was this tension within Judaism about not wanting angels to be worshipped. But there was always a fear that people would turn to angel worship and that would be the focus. And so there was a tradition that the 4 archangels are the ones who exist all the time, but every other angel, God arises during the day and then they dissolve at night, meaning that, or they only exist for 24 hours, sort of like the fruit fly life cycle, like they, you know, whatever. It's like they come into being and then they have a purpose for that day and then they dissolve, meaning
so
that they're
no hierarchy of angels like the cherubim and the seraph.
I mean, it exists in mysticism. They do talk about that, but I think that this, I love this idea that there's a host of new angels every single day that come into the universe. And then at the end of that day, they're retired. So that every single day there's a need for a new host of ministering angels to go out into the world to do their work, but then they dissolve, and so that they're completely temporal. They don't, you know, sort of like continuing on the sort of the metaphor of the sun and the refraction, that they don't exist beyond that moment of encounter or need. And they come into your life or into your consciousness for right then and there, and then move on. And that it's these four, and that was, and I thought that was just a really beautiful understanding of the angelic. That it's, you know, hard to, it's not something you can hold on to and grasp eternally, while these other four are more pillar kind of angels that exist in perpetuity. So I just wanted to share that piece before we dive more deeply into the four ministering angels.
I'm just thinking about time. What time does lunch end?
1:15,
yeah.
I'm thinking that perhaps what we could do, the description of the guardian angels here is actually adapted from descriptions that were posted with some angels that three of us, including me, did art projects at a recent event, the recent porn party. And you can probably read those. I think that, I'm wondering, would you like to see some slides now?
Yeah.
Okay. And if we go 5 minutes over, is that okay?
Yep.
Technology, the angel will be here.
She knows.
So these are simply some different interpretations of angels. Point of information, there are some of my artwork in this. So this is Here we have Jacob Steinhardt, Abraham hosting the angels. You know, kind of an interesting mixture of Eastern Europe and the Middle Eastern desert.
They definitely saw themselves in that.
Yes.
They look like they're woodcuts.
I'm guessing they were all white with beards.
So this is just kind of a smorgasbord of different approaches to the idea of angels. This is some stereotypical imagery, and then some other things. So this is biblical illustration from the Jehovah's Witness website.
Okay.
And then this is something that I found with, this is about Balaam's donkey. Balaam's ass. I've taught bar and bat mitzvah, and I've had kids do incredible drama about this story. It's a great story for anybody to do theater around, and the kids just love it when they're doing theater about Balaam's ass.
I can imagine. They want to say that word.
And this is something I found on the Chabad, which is a very orthodox branch within Judaism, where it's interesting, the donkey, you know, there's the kind of reign of Hebrew letters, and there's this urban environment, what looks like an urban environment, and the donkey, is she turning away? Is she being quiescent? Is she being stubborn? Turning away from the path? Is this the angel or is this Balaam? Lots of questions here. It's interesting. And then
And then this is just a little bit from my own experience. This is a donkey at the village at Aptawani in the South Hebron Hills. And I went, and I can talk more about this tonight when we talk about Israel and Palestine. But I went with a delegation of people, and we slept on rooftops in this village. And you know, under the stars on cement rooftops before going to do peace and justice work, creating a camp nearby, working with Israelis and Palestinians. And this donkey brayed very loudly, roughly every 45 minutes, starting maybe about 3 in the morning. And was that donkey an angel? That donkey was making sure that we woke up. You know, making sure in a very irritating way. Have you ever heard a donkey bray?
Yes.
It's not just a hee-haw, is it?
Yes.
It is an amazing sound. Anyway, yes. So I couldn't resist putting this donkey in. That is the donkey that kept me awake.
I just want to share one short thing about this, which is that my bar mitzvah this weekend, his interpretation of the story is that the purpose of this encounter with the angel and the donkey is the angel that makes you question whether you're heading in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. The donkey won't move and is right in front of you, and he's using his force to move it out of the way. And it's the angel that says, "Am I moving in the right direction?" Or,
mm-hmm.
And that questioning of self and that pause. And I just thought.
And what form does that take?
You avoid great interpretation.
And what form does that take? I have to admit, I'm rather uneasy with this description of an angel, this visual description.
Caucasian angel.
Yeah.
But it's very,
it looks like that.
In terms of our general societal stereotype of what an angel would be, that fits in, doesn't it?
Yeah.
As one manifestation.
This is not usually so masculine.
So this is a very expressive donkey. Here's something that goes in, and we'll talk more about this tomorrow, but this is something that goes in a more kind of foreboding direction. This is by the artist Leonard Baskin, and this is the theme here is the sacrifice of Isaac. And I don't actually have a photograph right now of the face of this figure, but it's almost has like a helmet, and it doesn't have much of a face, but it's this massive form forming the back of what I assume is the figure of Isaac.
Are those wings?
And the wing-like quality.
Are the wings are over him from the back?
Yes,
oh.
Almost like embracing, but the angel is facing away. This figure is facing away.
Oh.
And it's very ambiguous. On the other hand, is it Abraham turning away?
No. It's the angel and allowing its wings to protect Isaac.
Yeah, but the angels, the wings, are they on the figure of Isaac or are they the angels? It's very ambiguous, which is part of the power of art, you know, makes us think. And then here the ram is right there.
Take me.
And by the way, Johanna, have you heard the Maner Midrash about the ram?
The what?
About the modern midrash of the ram, it kind of goes in line with what we were talking about. What's the identity of the donkey?
Mm-hmm.
There's a ram grazing in a field, and there's a voice that comes from the heavens: "Ram, ram." And the ram says, "Hineni, here I am." And the voice tells the ram, "I want you to go up on the hill. And there's a father about to kill his son, a human father, and I want you to substitute yourself, to put yourself in that boy's place." And the ram says, "Why should I do that?" And to make it short, the ram bargains with that heavenly voice and wins all the laws about treating animals with humanity. And then the ram said, and then the ram says, "But do they have to eat us?" But, you know, the voice says, "Well, basically, I really want them to be vegetarians, but they're not ready for that yet." But at least if you have to, you know, it's kind of a hard midrash. If you have to die they should kill you as painlessly as possible. It's kind of a current diction, but it's a nice modern midrash. And here's some other images. Samuel Bach, if you haven't looked at his work, it's really interesting. Dress Rehearsal is the title of this. And this is another image by Leonard Baskin, who did the sculpture. And Yom Kippur is the very intense day of atonement, of turning, of what many people, when they use the English word, like to pronounce at-one-ment. And when you're doing the heavy lifting of really trying to turn your behavior around towards the path of decency. Here is a painting by Rembrandt. Rembrandt is an interesting artist in a lot of ways, as certainly when I was thinking of becoming an artist, Rembrandt was one of my heroes. Often, sometimes, the touch that Rembrandt shows is very humane. So, is this wrestling? Or is it an embrace? The angel and the human, their stances are quite different, aren't they? What is Jacob feeling? What is the angel expressing? It's a surprisingly strange painting.
And very different from Rembrandt's, in my opinion, other paintings. You know, it's like, it's actually softer. It's not as defined as Rembrandt's paintings.
I want to confirm when he painted this, how old he was.
Mm-hmm.
With Rembrandt, there's a definite shift in the course of his life, from being, among other things, extremely successful to having a series of trials and tribulations, and also a journey from a painting style that you said is much more defined, much more slick in certain ways, to really a painting that is among some of the first, I would say, modern art.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
I wonder if this was commissioned by someone. It sort of has that look like, please do me a painting, I will pay you, of this scene, and because it doesn't feel like he's resolved anything in it himself.
Yeah. This is by Gauguin, The Vision After the Sermon. This is interesting, the extent to which the people are observing or not observing, and the way the composition is done, the isolation of the wrestling figures. And then right here is this form.
What is that?
But the variety of responses that we sense. But it's curious how, she's turning away. She's showing devotion, but she's also turning away. How do we respond to events like this? Two much more modern interpretations. Chagall did a lot of interesting work. I personally relate more to his earlier work. The way he shows human bodies frequently, these are very sturdy bodies. They're lumpy, sturdy. Now, I don't think he drew as well as some other people did, but I was intrigued by the way he shows the forms, and again, the sense of expressiveness and the ambiguous character of what's being expressed.
It's so intimate, it almost, like the both body positions, there's this almost this sexual intimacy with contact.
And this is an artist, Grisha Bruskin, who was a Jewish artist who left the Soviet Union and does some really interesting work. I encourage you to look him up. And you know, very different ways of sewing wrestling, yes? And showing the angelic figure. They have both adopted the, in many ways, the European idea of angels, and I think also the, well, both the European and Muslim idea of angels having wings. In Judaism, there isn't so much of an idea of angels having wings. The presence of the Shekhinah, the presence of the divine in the world, has wings, is often shown as wings, like people are sheltered under the wings of the divine. But not so much angels, but they accepted it. But yes, this is this fiery angel and sense of intimacy and detachment at the same time. It's interesting.
A lot of his paintings, in like the, I think it's the Paris Opera House, mm-hmm. you know, vibrant colors, but he, you know, I think very much in love with his wife, and he had everything floating above the earth.
Yes.
People and animals, and I think there were some that were the wrestling scenes, but it was like he was very light and airy, and, you know, love was the theme. So it's interesting to see him with the struggle piece.
Yeah. By the way, with Chagall, notice the stance of the leg. Okay. Some artists are working with that, and of course, when Jacob wrestles with the angel, he's injured, and he limps. Mm-hmm. He's injured in the hip, and he limps for the rest of his life. Mm-hmm. So he's marked by his struggle. And now we're looking at abstract angels. So this is from the book from the Sefer Raziel HaMalach, Raziel the Angel, which is very, very much about magic. And probably, Johanna, this looks kind of familiar in terms of some of the traditions your mother was expressing, even though this is from Central Europe, Eastern Europe.
I have a question. How might it look familiar? Like, where would those images have been made known to you?
Well, it's familiar just because it's something that I took this image and painted it and put it above my child's bed when he was born, because these are specifically angels that protect newborn children.
Okay.
So that is just familiar to me from just a cultural heritage, but also that they're abstract. Because, again, going towards this idea of not wanting to worship something that's too much in a human form. And so here they're like really abstractions, and they're made up, you know, they're from our...
Yeah. And they would often be used in amulets.
That's
all through,
what I was
all
asking
through
for.
The
amulets,
all through the Jewish world.
Pieces of adornment that you would wear.
Not necessarily these guys, but these guys were familiar to me as being images that you would put near a baby's crib. For protection.
Like a dream catcher.
So this, and this is very much a book out of the tradition of very, very intense Jewish mysticism. And these are indeed images of angels.
And you can get stuffed animals of them on Etsy now.
Well, yeah.
there they are.
There.
Kabbalah dog.
Sansoni, Sanoi, and Salman Gleef. F.A.O. Schwartz, Kabbalah dolls. you can see this is the same image from the book of Raziel, the angel. here we have the angel dolls. It's kind of strange, isn't it?
It'd be great to have a t-shirt.
Kind of charming. Okay. This is by a fellow named, these are images from Ignaty Nowinski, who's a really interesting person, and there isn't very much I've been able to find out about him. He was one of the people very involved with the Habima Theater during the flowering of Jewish culture in the early Soviet Union. There was an explosion of avant-garde radical Jewish culture between about 1918 and about 1930 in the Soviet Union. Sometimes with a lot of struggle, and it was destroyed by Stalinism. And it did have to struggle because of the push and pull between allowing ethnic expression and a sense of self-determination and pressing down of that sense of ethnic self-determination in the name of the Soviet state. But and Novinsky was not Jewish, but he worked very, very closely with Jewish artists as part of Habima Theater. And he immersed himself in the study of Eastern European Jewish culture. And these are straight out of inspiration from the Book of Raziel. And I love these. I think they're just fantastically weird and disturbing and kind of ominous. And in some cases, the words don't mean something. And in other cases, they are the names of the angels that are shown in those figures we looked at earlier.
Those remind me of the totem figures.
Mm-hmm. But his response, these pieces, these costume designs, they're inspired by traditional amulets, and they do represent the tradition, part of the tradition. So, you know, this, you know, from the very human to the very abstract, there's a spectrum. And that's going to be expressed more here by more work by Grisha Bruskin. He is being inspired by the folk traditions, the folk art of Jews in Eastern Europe. Something very, very traditional, quote unquote, from the 1500s, early 1600s, a response to the Book of Ezekiel. More of that response. This is obviously from the Christian traditions. The Book of Ezekiel being very psychedelic. More, you know, figuring out how do we depict this verbal imagery. William Blake, and I have a fondness for this particular mosaic.
That's a mosaic?
Yes.
Wow. Wonder how big it is. Oh, look at the wheels at the bottom under the feet.
Yes. The wheels. Remember, there's what they call the ofanim, the wheels with eyes. I don't think that these have eyes on them, but wheels are, in the Book of Ezekiel, are a powerful image. Here we are. Angels. From a church in Macedonia from 1836. We don't know who the artist was, but a relatively literal just interpretation of the prophetic text. And more things responding in one way or another. I don't know who this artist is. I found this online, but again, working with the idea from the Book of Ezekiel, and then this is from the artist Odilon Redon, a French artist who did very surrealistic work. I couldn't resist showing this.
That's the original hairy eyeball.
And here's another work by Redon, the guardian spirit of the waters. So he's not necessarily doing angels, quote unquote, but it seemed apropos. This is the artist Ruth Star Rose, and remember I talked about the idea of angels for people under stress in an oppressive situation, refugees, people facing racism and oppression, and she did a lot of work as an artist who came out of the Southern African American community. And the image of the wheel in Ezekiel became very powerful in the Black church in the South.
Yes.
And you know, the working with the vision of Ezekiel and the wheel of the windmill and the sharecropper, hoping for strength and resilience. Here's another approach by the American Jewish artist. Family came from the Tsarist Empire as immigrants. I think Bitschon was actually born in Lithuania. A great socially conscious artist. And the children under the watch of the cherubim, which are another form of angels.
So this was during the war?
Hmm. Yeah, he did this in 1944. So, kind of working with the idea of a protective presence. Now I'm going to talk very briefly, show you very briefly, because we don't have, we're running out of time, about some of my own process of trying to figure out angels. I was thinking about some of the combination of the tradition of showing people with bird heads. In the Jewish tradition, at certain times, there's a famous thing called the bird's head Haggadah, where the active people in the story have the heads of birds, and also the very abstract amulets that we were looking at, and trying to figure out angels as monopods, or standing on one foot, and just trying to work things out, and looking at some really old figures I saw from Mesopotamia in the British Museum that were like, what, about 4,000 years old?
At least.
And so and I was going with my own, kind of trying to figure out, how do I do art that shows angels? And I ended up with these. So I've got, in the handout, I've got descriptions talking about the about some attributes of these. But what I'll say briefly is that these are about 9 feet tall. It was important to make them big. They're actually painted with acrylic on Tyvek. Great stuff for both doing certain kinds of art and doing political banners. And these are rather more didactic than I think I would do them a second time because of the context in which they were made. But this is Raphael, and Raphael's an angel of healing, and is often talked about having many multiple human faces. And Raphael cleans up after our mistakes, cleans up. When we make mistakes, when we commit sins, when we go off the path, Raphael is often there as someone who cleans up our mess. So we have, and also the snake is in many cultures a symbol of healing. The story, one midrash says that when Jacob wrestled with a mysterious figure and injured his thigh, his hip, that Raphael placed his hand on the injury to help it heal. And also that Raphael is one of the stewards of human knowledge, of what's called the book of Adam, the book of the human creature, that Raphael safeguarded that through the eons. And frankly, when I think about this, I kind of think about some of those Hindu figurines with the multiple arms. This is Gabriel, and there's Gabriel, you know, represents heroism and strength and also restraint. And there's a story, a midrash, that Gabriel is the angel that was sent throughout the world to collect, to the four corners of earth, to collect all the different kinds of dirt of earth that would be made, that would be used to make the earth creature, the first human. Because Adam comes from Adama, earth. And so that nobody could say, my earth, the dirt I was made from is better than the dirt you were made from, because it's all mixed up from the four corners of the earth. So he's got the earth, he's associated with fire in one interpretation, and justice. And there's a nice, a wonderful midrash that the tree of life still exists, and the blossoms of the tree of life fall and become human souls. And Gabriel safeguards them in a chest and then doles them out as each person is born. And this is Michael. And Michael is associated with compassion, with mercy, with chesed. And often is associated with being the angel who substituted the ram for Isaac. And this is the one that was associated with, that was inspired by the figure that's 4,000 years ago, a little figure this big from the Middle East. But also, Michael is the mailman, delivers messages that brings the hopes of people up to the heavens. And there's a wonderful story, Michael and Gabriel, Michael and Gabriel often get kind of put together in different roles, but the story that there are threads connecting every human soul with the divine, and that every time we make a mistake of certain sorts, that thread breaks, and figures like Michael are moving around, tying the string back together. So that's why he is a mailman on a Segway.
On a Segway.
And these also, there are forces of earth, wind, and fire, ice or snow and fire that are associated with these different characters. And these are Hamsas, because there's the idea, a Hamsa is a Jewish and Islamic tradition around the Mediterranean and the Middle East of the hand that wards off the evil eye, that pushes away bad luck and misfortune. But also, it's interesting because it's also represents vision in a certain way, right? So that's my response to the idea of angels. And those of you who are coming back, I will be really curious to see what your response is going to be.
Thank you.
Rainer, Michael, my understanding from the Christian scripture that I've been associated with, Michael the archangel is the warrior that's fighting against evil. Martin Luther has a hymn called A Mighty Fortress, and there's one verse in there that talks about it's a battle against the principalities of evil. And Michael the archangel, it's in the book of Daniel, and it's also in Revelation. It's about the war in heaven.
Both Michael and Gabriel are often shown in martial ways as well.
Okay.
I have to admit, I was choosing to focus.
Okay, on, so you know about that other view.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I plan to come back.
Okay.
There's a duality of a spectrum of how they're represented.
Well, I love
thank you for your patience. Please go eat lunch.
Thank you so much.